If you want a good illustration of how much great TV is available right now, consider what's happening on Hulu. Last year, The Handmaid's Tale put the streaming service on the map with Emmys for Outstanding Drama and for Elizabeth Moss for Lead Actress in a Drama. At the time, Hulu already had an Emmy-caliber drama called The Path, starring Aaron Paul, Hugh Dancy, and Michelle Monaghan, a riddle of a cult religion wrapped in a love triangle inside a family drama. The backstory in the first two seasons, that a guy named Steve Meyer discovered a mystical ladder in the sky in the early 1970s and started a movement, becomes a big part of the main story in season three, which is airing now. This season, Aaron Paul's Eddie experiences a miracle that's captured on video, and he becomes something like a messiah. Kyle Allen plays his son and an up-and-comer in the Meyerists. Jessica Goldberg created the series.
Do you have any idea how much the novices believe in you? You made magic happen, a miracle before their eyes, and now because of one angry father, you're just gonna back down.
Look, it is not that simple. You cannot imagine the pressure that I am under being in charge of all of these young people.
I am one of them. I am their youth leader. I understand how they feel. You can't just kick people out.
How about how I felt when you shunned me? I'm not doing that to another family. Never.
That's not your choice to make for other people. You made a commitment to be our father. That means you listen to what we need. God, you are so busy trying not to be a cult leader, you're not being a leader at all.
Knock it off, okay? You don't get a free pass around here because you're my kid. Show some fucking respect. Hawk, I'm not done with you. Hawk!
Well, I want to start first on this health trend that's apparently sweeping Hollywood, and it's apparently from the show The Hypoxian Cleanse.
Yeah, I think that's really catching on.
Have you had your hypoxian cleanse or your first one of the year yet?
We actually had a party the other night.
Yeah.
And I made a special drink called the Hypoxian Cleanse.
Yeah. What was in it?
It had mezcal.
Yep.
And grapefruit juice and jalapeno peppers.
And no oxygen.
It's
yeah,
good.
Exactly.
No, my friend had a, I drove. Let's just say that much.
Yeah, so I had one and it was strong. Yeah.
Let me start with that again, I guess, because that is I think a fascinating thing that's happening this season and a good place to start with talking about the show. Give me the sort of the layman's explanation for what the hypoxian cleanse is and what's happening with that on the show.
Yeah, it's an old form of punishment that Michelle Monaghan's character finds that the founder of this movement used to sort of, you know, sort of like flogging or what did the Catholic priests do?
They did a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I liken it to in the Da Vinci Code. There's the one character who's got that belt around his thigh that just kind of like he just holds spikes.
Yes.
And that's what he forces himself through every single day.
And of course it's very S&M-y, and I think kind of erotic, even though
you didn't quite do it for me in that regard. but I was intrigued. I was definitely
you weren't the one tied up, Kyle.
No,
I mean, maybe you need to experience
as an observer.
Really...
as an observer. Yeah, perhaps. You know, don't knock it till you try it. But I think I've been scarred, you know.
Yeah.
In a good way.
Is the idea that it's a form of penitence? Is the discomfort and the pain the point of it, or is it something about the breathing that's where that comes from?
I think it's both.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're punishing yourself and you're trying to have a physical reminder of, like, for instance, I imagine Steve used it to remind himself that his urges were wrong, to bear those bruises, to walk around with them.
It's also really interesting, and something that I've, some things that I've studied is actually these breathing exercises that you can do to kind of like supposedly release past trauma. And you'll come up with all these stories and these reasons, like Michelle Monaghan's character does. And Cal's like, no, that's not it. That's not it. And then she keeps going, and then they go tighter and tighter and tighter until finally the truth comes out. Mm-hmm. In the same way you're doing these breathing exercises and you're like, this is what's bothering me. And you're like, no, that didn't do it. And then this is what's bothering me. This is what's bothering me. And then you finally put a name to it, and it releases finally. And so I assimilate those two practices.
That's very smart. Yeah. I was not there.
I mean, you can't do that with a straight face and still have a working relationship after. I mean, that's, you got to have humor in that.
It comes off so intense, though. I was so surprised to hear that. And you know, when I saw it, I was so blown away by their bravery.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't there.
You're on Hulu at an interesting time. If you look at a cable or broadcast show that's in its third season right now, you'd probably see the ratings dwindling a little bit for season two and dwindling a little more for season three as people are leaving those cable and broadcast ecosystems. I know you don't have the ratings, and you know Hulu, as most streaming services, is not public with those things, but there's probably at least an inference that your viewership is growing from season to season as people are catching up. Do you have a sense of that from social media or from your...
I find it's stronger. I mean, I'm not involved on the business and production side of any of it, but just from the last person who gets told things, I've felt... we've just gained momentum, which is cool, because I think we had the opportunity to plan these other seasons and to build these up.
Yeah.
And to build to this point, whereas I feel like other you know, network and cable shows never have the opportunity to prepare for a second and third season. So the story suffers, the content suffers. You feel like they're pulling, you know, typical moves, and that's when it just kind of gets soapy, and then you're done. You check out.
We try to ask Hulu, and I do think that Handmaid's Tale has helped the network or whatever, the streaming service. You know, I think it's, you know, when we sort of started there was very little original content. So I'm hopeful that maybe some of that new viewership will check out The Path.
Going back to the very beginning of the series and all the way through this season, there's a few different ways to frame the show. You can frame it as a family drama. And Jess, I know you came from Parenthood before this show. You could frame it as a show about organizational dynamics and how power works in a company or a business or an organization. You could frame it as like about a love triangle, which there's an element of, and there's a lot of characters. And so you can kind of see all of those different things. Tell me about the show, I guess, particularly from this season's perspective, as a show about a historical foundation for belief.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I find it that this year more than any of those other things, like a big allegory of American faith, the idea that we can, in this country and in other countries, but create faith, create religion. And then, you know, these characters are, in a weird way, like this year, Aaron Paul is sort of God, you know, so they all represent, you know, sort of archetypal people in a mythological story about creation, you know.
Hawk is a faun.
Hawk is a faun.
Or a centaur.
And you play Aaron Paul's son, and people jokingly call you, you know, son of God, Jesus' son, those sorts of things. And it's a thing. I mean, it's in the culture of the organization that he's got this messianic-like position in season three.
Yeah, no, he has an immense amount of power. And, I mean, gosh, I wouldn't want my dad to be Jesus. I'd just be, no thanks.
And walking through him, you know, that Aaron's character has been through this down and back up relationship with the organization and in his own beliefs. What did he believe at the bottom of that? And what does he believe now coming all the way back up to the top?
Well, I think he believed in this essential message, you know, whatever it is, of the light. And then, this year, I think he's really struggling as the season progresses with who the messenger was. And so sort of separate, I mean, I'm sure many people in many religions have to do this. They have to go like, that priest, that doesn't necessarily represent what the core value of Catholicism is, or, I mean, that's just an example.
And he's redefining it to an extent too, which is almost Pope-like.
Yes.
Comparison, mm-hmm. that he's been able to make changes to the, I talk about that a little bit. Like there's earlier in the show, if you left the religion, if you left the faith, your family that was still in the faith shunned you. They no longer acknowledged you or talked to you. And he's done away with that. What are some of the other changes?
Well, the punishment, he doesn't believe there was a lot of, sort of these little white rooms that people would go into if they were misbehaved in any way. Obviously, you couldn't not believe, you couldn't question. So he's sort of allowing all those things to exist within the religion, and we'll see if that works.
Yeah, which also opens up Hawk's character to have a relationship with someone from another faith.
And Hawk has never waffled, right? Hawk has always been, I mean, right on the core of the beliefs of the movement.
He had some doubts in season one, mm-hmm. Specifically because of his father, and then turned around before Eddie did in season two, and then committed fully because he had his own experience of connection with the light, and that actually caused First, the dad left, and then Hawk was confused about that, and then so Hawk then he came around, and then they were both separate, and then I came back to the movement, and my dad wasn't there, and so then we were separate, and now we're together again, back in the movement, headstrong,
stronger than ever.
Jess, as far as what the movement actually is, I mean, you and I have talked about this two or three times before, and it is in my head all the time as I'm watching the show, that the elements of Confucianism and Catholicism and, sort of animal spirits sort of religions. And how do you think of it? Do you think of it as a non-theistic or pantheistic religion? How do you think of it?
Well, I suppose there's one source of, one God.
Definitely. I mean, it ties into just about every religion has the ultimate end. You know, if it's energy or light or universe or God or the Taoist, it's kind of this unspeakable sort of rhythm of knowledge that kind of exists beyond anyone's comprehension.
But it's never personified. It's never a
no.
he. It's
right,
never a
correct. Yeah,
it's a yeah. It's the light. I mean, it's
the light.
It's like achieving. I guess I'm sort
not
of,
the dark.
No,
specifically not the dark.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely a conglomeration. And when we're making the show, the base of the show is to create a religion that's very friendly and warm and that, accepting and loving. And then, when we need conflict, we throw on the rules.
One of the things you get the opportunity to do because the show is scripted about a created faith rather than being based on Scientology or based on Catholicism or some other particular religion is that you can fill it with whatever you want. And so the the possibility is out there that this thing might be real. This could be the truth. And I think we've seen elements, particularly with Aaron Paul's character. I think at the end of season two, he had like a premonition about something when he was putting gas in his car and turned around. And I mean, Kyle, the thing where you floated off the ground, and the show does not use, you know, a lot of dreamy imagery. So I think it's at least out there that maybe or even probably really happened. Has that been interesting, I guess, from both sides, from writing it and from acting it, to like hold out that possibility that this stuff might all be real?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's just like when you get in a room with a bunch of writers and start talking about God, even if they all started as atheists, there's like moments where they're like, you know, my mom really saw an angel, or, you know, like, there, we can't deny that there is something, or, you know, there is this mysticism, whether, you know, there's eventually conversation comes to that and people become not so sure anymore.
Has Michelle's character been a true believer the whole time? I get the impression that she has, but that she makes compromises in sort of selfish ways sometimes, but that it's never been as in the form of deviating from her beliefs.
Yeah, this is her first season of deep questioning. But up until now, she's been, you know.
What about some of the other characters on the show? I mean, is there a... for the most part, the people that are in the compound have been on board the whole time, right? They grew up in this.
Yeah, certainly like Michelle's family, her mom, her dad. Cal, to me, is the most complicated as far as belief, because I kind of don't even know.
I don't either.
Yeah, like sometimes I think he's convinced himself that he believes, and sometimes, you know, I just feel like it's all he has.
I mainly think it's, I mean, from an outside perspective, I mainly think it's all he has. He doesn't have the luxury of questioning.
Yeah.
There's nothing for him outside of it.
But I think it's very malleable for him in a very Trumpian way, where it's more about its utility than about its certainty.
That is a great observation.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely think he uses it to satiate, you know, to fill the holes that exist in him.
And how much over the course of the three seasons do you feel like you're working within a narrow space with what you can do with their beliefs?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because, you know, everyone is sort of, especially with Aaron and Michelle, because in season one, Aaron didn't believe. Season two, he didn't believe. Now he's like the biggest believer. Michelle believed, didn't, is questioning everything. Yeah. If we have a season four, I guess we'll have to figure out.
Well, I mean, and in the heat of all those changes of believing and not believing, it's never that simple, because those things are costing different people different things at different times as the movement itself develops. You know, because now Sarah's not sacrificing everything if she doesn't believe, which is, you know, perhaps the only reason she's bothering to question things now.
I think one of the things that's been really interesting about season three, from me as a person who's written a lot about history over the years, is that you're developing an actual historical record for this organization and for their beliefs. And there was the film strip in one of the early episodes, and you've got the records that were kept by Dr. Meyer. What were you thinking when you were doing that? What was the purpose of adding those physical sort of historical pieces to the show?
Well, this show does function as sort of a mystery each season. And you know, as we sort of went through season one and two, people that I talked to always, like, you know, had questions about the origins, and, you know, I those questions became really evocative to me. And so in a weird way, season three is the mystery of where we come from, you know?
And is that something that you think there's more there there's more in that shoebox to look at in a later season?
I think we would sort of be, I imagine, you know, moving forward, it would be like, now that you know, that's sort of where season three goes, is once they find out, they have some really painful decisions to make. And then it would be about the creation of how you take what was good from the past and, you know, create something new. So I would imagine a more sort of epic and new landscape.
That, you know, going back to Cal, there's and about his beliefs, there's something fairly early, and I think maybe episode 4 or 5 in the this current season, where he knows some things that would potentially rock the foundation of belief and would cast a negative light on some things. And so you see some malleability there with him, but it just makes you wonder about applying that context to almost everything. And you can see in, you know, if you read much history or read things that have been unearthed that were not a part of the you know, the history all along the way, there's a tremendous resistance to those things, that they've not been part of the story all along. And I don't want them in the story now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're seeing it play out, you know, with our leaders, you know.
That, what do you mean?
You know, like, that didn't happen. I didn't sleep with that woman. You know, like, there's like a lot of revisionist history happening, and particularly in religion, you know, that's that people definitely want to protect an image.
Well, the show I wouldn't say is political, but the one area that comes to mind, I mean, you might disagree with that, but for me, the one area where that comes to mind is immigration. And that's not something we've really talked about much in the past. And I'm curious what you'd say about why that's something that tends to come up over and over. I think as far back as season 1, that's something that you've been talking about on the show.
I think, I mean, a lot of religions, I mean, it's so interesting even that, like, you know, what Steve Bannon said about the Catholic Church and their interest in immigration. I mean, it's, I think religion is supposed to be this refuge, and that can cause conflict with governments, you know.
And where are some of the ideas that you've been applying to that coming from? I think in season 1, you had some refugees and there was a question about whether to protect them or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, we've always sort of been interested in the intersection of government, and I think it's less so this season, but that intersection of, you know, where religion and government butt heads. It's just such a complicated time because on one hand, there's a sort of aggressive, you know, desire to make the government, you know, like more, you know, Christian or have these kind of values. And on the other hand, it's just when certain values suit the policies. But in our heads as writers, we always get interested in where those two things butt heads.
What about the environmental part? Where does that come from for you?
Well, that's a really big part of this particular religion. There is like a real sort of, you know, caring of the earth. This is our home. We build a garden. We return to this garden. There's a sense that the apocalypse will be man-made. It will be, you know, from global warming, that it's our own doing. So that's just like a fundamental part of Meyerism.
I also think it makes him more accessible and attractive to other people. Well, I mean, that when I'm looking at it, I always say they look so great from the outside. I mean, they're all about, you know, breathing and acceptance and coming into yourself and connecting with anyone no matter what, and, you know, caring for the environment and being vegetarian. I'm like, oh, that's like, and everyone love each other and live together. It's like, oh, great. Like, what's not to like?
And Kyle, there was a particular environmental story in the second season that was probably the main story for you in season 2, would you say?
Yeah.
Tell me about that a little bit, about sort of how that, what happened with you and sort of how you felt about that as you were going through it.
I mean, that wasn't a difficult part to play. I mean, it's a frustrating thing. It's a result of, you know, I think how our society's built is we've given this power to people who are kind of, you know, I don't know, boosting our economy and the various things they do. They just have this, extra oomph in getting things done. So they get a protection regardless of the damage that they do to the environment and the people that are, you know, below their status. Yeah, there's a woman, Mr. Khan, who owned a chemical company, and they were dumping things in the water that were poisoning this farming community. And, you know, they covered up the proof and they did testing and things like that. And I went to go pull a prank on them with one of the other novices, and I got really pissed off and went too far, smashed a rock through their window, and then she blackmails us and says, stop, I'll drop the charges if you stop looking into this water thing that she's the cause of. And so we're like, okay, but then she doesn't stop, and so they slap me with a domestic terrorist charge, and I go to prison.
The show, from the beginning, has had a very representational, positive approach to casting. How does that play out in the show? I mean, from the very core of the show, this group in the 70s was very multi-ethnic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's sort of like, you know, I think when you're creating a religion, I think it's like, goes back to what Kyle said, where you want it to look like, you want it to look, you know, enticing and like the melting pot, like the American. Yeah. You form a religion in 1970 to like be a new America, be the dream of America. I mean, obviously it doesn't go well, but that was what the 60s were about in a way, you know.
There's a side story at the earliest episodes of the current season with Hugh Dancy that I found really funny. Mm-hmm. In certain parts and in ways that the show hasn't really struck me as funny or dark, even darkly funny in some cases with that particular story. Tell me where that came from and what you were doing at the beginning of the season with him.
Well, I really enjoy, I think you get to season three and you're like, let's have a little fun. And Cal is somebody you can have a little, I mean, the show is also like, it's so serious, so it's nice to have some humor. I think you're referring to the football player who.
Absolutely.
I enjoy it. I just really enjoy that story. But we were just sort of thinking of, like, this year when we went about thinking about the show, we thought like, who is attracted to these movements? Like, what does it look like in our world, you know, our modern world? And he seemed like such an unlikely candidate for a master.
To set it up, Cal is basically like a live-in guru for this retired NFL quarterback. Is that right?
That is right. And he's like 35, you know, he has CTE and he's a little crazy.
And a man baby who's extremely, extremely dependent on Cal.
Yes. Yes. I just thought it was fun. And I thought, and he will come back, which is exciting. He comes back in our
season. I love that. I love that story. Yeah. I was so happy with how that came out.
Yeah. You know,
we
tried to broaden the world a bit in season three.
And he's played by William Popp, who I didn't know before the series. How did you find him? Did you just do casting auditions for?
Yeah, I mean, what a discovery!
Because I totally bought him as a retired NFL
he's
quarterback.
So good.
He's really good. I think we found him on a tape. We have a great casting person, James Caleri, casting in New York, and you know, he's probably like a theater actor who does like musical theater, which is like half our cast. But I don't know that for sure. But like most actors in New York are
just better.
Raul Esparza, who we have this year, is like, you know, a diva, a singer.
Kyle, you're a theater kid, right?
I'm a dance theater kid.
You haven't gotten to dance on the show yet.
I have not gotten to dance on the show yet. That is correct.
Maybe he's too good.
They'll create a Myra's hip hop group or something. We originally shot around an idea of like having some crazy tripped out dream sequence where I could do a bunch of flips or something. Other than that, it would just kind of like not really make sense for a Hawk to wake up and just
to suddenly be doing 20 pirouettes.
And you had long hair when the show started. Tell me about like deciding to cut your hair and whether you were talked into that or not talked into
it. Oh yeah, that was funny. That was funny. I think what about sums it up would be,
you had like Tim Riggins hair, right?
Longer.
Yeah. I had, it was a mane. It was madness. I loved it. But I think what about sums it up is that, Jess later came to me and I think near to the end of the season was like, yeah, we had to make two really difficult decisions this season. Like the ones that we had like the most difficulty getting past, you know, the most resistance in the various rooms that these things have to go through and get cleared on. And one of them was Clark Middleton's character, Richard, the shaman of, or not the shaman, but one of the main guides of the movement. His death was something that they, you know, his self-immolation near the end of season two was one decision. And the other decision was cutting my hair. So I think that sums it up. It was its own character.
We had this card.
And it needed to die.
We had these, we put cards on the wall and we put a card up that said, Kyle cuts his hair. And Jason Kadams, who's from Friday Nights in Parenthood, came in the room and he just like was stunned. He was like, he was like, are you really going to do, you know, like Felicity, it took her so long after the hair. Whoa. You know, like it just like, he was quite,
it was funny being on set. And like, I remember I didn't know right away. I think someone had read it before I did. And I think Aaron came up to me first and was like, hey, so I just want you to know that whatever you decide, I've got your back. And I'm like, what are we talking? I'm like, your hair, you don't know. And I was like, what? And he was like, just read the thing and just know that whatever you decide got your back. And then like the next day, Hugh was like, hey man, whatever you decide. And like, I was thinking like, of course I'm going to cut my hair. And I'm thinking like, should I not cut my hair? Like, is this some sort of thing? Am I like shooting myself in the foot? And then ultimately it went on for like another month. And then Jess just called me and was like, hey, Kyle, can we cut your hair? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, I think it'd be like cool. And I'd be like, I was like, yeah, be cool.
I think it was a great decision.
I agree. I agree. It was summer. It was so hot. I was so happy.
It's just funny how hair is such a, like, it was much more a big deal than the Hypoxian cleanse, Kyle. Well,
I don't know. I don't know whether you should
sooner
take
be
this.
Tied up, sooner be tied up and strangled on television than get your hair cut.
Whether you should take this as a compliment or a neutral comment or an insult, but I gotta say, I miss Clark Middleton more than I miss the hair.
Yeah, no, me too. We all miss Clark. We have him on set. We invite him on set.
Yeah,
we love having him around. He's such a beautiful person. He actually runs this non-profit production company for a bunch of up and coming artists in New York called the Torn Page, and it's just like a really beautiful space for artists. And so I go there a lot and hang out with him. He's just pure love. Love that guy.
Another thing I wanted to ask about, partly because I just can't imagine how this happens as you're writing and making a show, but how do you handle the music? Is Will Bates, the composer, involved fairly early? Do
Yes.
you leave spaces for him? How does that work for the show?
I think the first year, now it's just like we just hand it over and he looks at the scenes and you know, we temp in his music and then this season, I think he changed it up a bit, which I really love.
I noticed that.
There was like a lot of discussion in the beginning, and he also, our pilot director was this wonderful director, Mike Cahill, and he had done all of Mike Cahill's films. So there was a real discussion about what the show would sound like. and it does have a bit of a,
nailed it.
I think you know, it has like a little bit of like a, is there something it's out there like quality. What,
yeah, it kind of sets you off.
And love they did another Earth, this beautiful film. I don't know if you've seen it. Mm-hmm. And that had that same, like, is there something out there?
Yeah. And did he do I, Origins as well? Yeah, he did that. Yeah, those are both in the same realm, I would definitely say. The guy wears fantastic coats.
He's a great dresser.
Well, the score.
Fantastic coats.
I mean, it's a great score, and I like it, and I'm sure I would love to listen to it on, you know, my headphones, you know, just as a good score. But it's as integrated into the series and integral to the series as the way you would think of, like, John Williams and Superman. Or, I mean, it's like, it is a very important element of the show. Much more so than the composer generally is with other dramas.
Well, that's a compliment. I mean,
the dream sequences and everything like that. What was it? Was it episode
four?
Four. Yeah, when the
they took the ayahuasca together.
Yep. Cal and Eddie in the woods, just hallucinating together. With all the creepy piano and the off canter stuff. I thought it was great.
So when do you get to hear those things? Does he get a cut of the episode with the temp track and then he sends it back to you with like a piano version of what the music is going to be? Or how does that work?
Yeah, we send him the cut and with the temp, and then we do a sound, you know, like a spotting session where we all sit together in a room and listen to it and discuss any kind of changes we want to make. And then, you know, we make them.
I mean, these are things that I do not generally talk to people about on, you know, when I talk to showrunners or actors or things like the score or the cinematography, but like the production design is a huge element of the show. The I logo is a huge element of the show. I mean, how do you think about, or I guess going back to the beginning of the show, how did you think about that element as fitting in to the show? Because you were dealing with Peru and with the compound from the very beginning.
Well, I think also it's just so important how these religions brand themselves. So we really did think about what their symbols would be, you know, the crosses, whatever. It's like the Jewish star. They're like,
I remember you telling me you wanted something really like ominous, you know, watching. So it's like the light, but it's an eye. And so the very thing that we worship is just like always watching. That's why they're in every room. They're above the dinner table in the living room, above the bed, you know?
Yes. It seems like it's a reminder like that you have, like your actions aren't happening, you know?
Yeah. You're never alone.
You're never alone. Your actions matter, you know? But, we got really lucky with both production designers we've had. And
David do that?
David did the first year and then Neil. Yeah. And then we just have great directors like 5 and 6, which is on next week. 5 and 6 are just so stunningly visual. And we had this amazing woman, Stacy Passon.
Oh my gosh.
Who did such a great job.
So good.
Well, I really appreciate you talking to me. I love the show and have talked to you off and on since the beginning about how much I've loved the show. And I really appreciate you all, the two of you, coming in and sitting down to talk about it.